Welcome to At the Letters. I'm Ben Nicholson-Smith here, and we'll soon be joined by Arden Swelling, who's in Philadelphia right now covering the Blue Jays and Phillies. So we will talk to Arden about all things Blue Jays, Marcus Stroman, Aaron Sanchez, Michael Saunders, and the Blue Jays offense that seems to be showing signs of life. After that, we'll talk to Jim Callis, the draft expert from MLB.com, and we'll talk to him about the Blue Jays draft, what they were able to do with their 2016 picks, all coming up on At the Letters.
1-1 pitch, breaking ball, hit deep to left field, hooking, there she goes, a grand slam! Number 15 this year, third grand slam in his career, and give Donaldson a 5 RBI day, and give the Blue Jays a 9-0 lead here in a 6-run third over Philadelphia.
I was looking for a pitch that I could hit, and it was a kind of a backup slider curveball, and it's been a little bit since I've been able to recognize that pitch and recognize it back and up and still keep the ball fair.
We are back on At the Letters and joined by Arden Swelling, who is in a hotel lobby somewhere in Philadelphia, I'm led to believe. How's it going, Arden?
Good, man. What's going on with you?
Not a whole lot. You are, of course, in Philadelphia to cover the Blue Jays and Phillies, and it's one of those weird two-part, four-game series broken up over the course of two cities, 4 days, and we've already seen the Blue Jays play Philadelphia, most recently with Marcus Stroman bouncing back. I mean, we talked about him last week, and it seems as though a lot of those adjustments that we had talked about in terms of hypotheticals actually bore themselves out in reality the other day.
Yeah, I think he made some really good adjustments when, he was kind of talking to us after the game about how, mechanically, when he was throwing his sinker, he really had to focus on kind of keeping his core muscles tight. So, you think about kind of, abdominals and obliques and things like that. And it kind of makes sense when you think about it, because when he's really trying to kind of stay on top of that sinker, for him to stay as kind of tight and tall, he's the shortest pitcher in the major leagues. So for him to stay as high up as possible, I mean, that's really going to help him kind of be on top of it and get as much downward plane as he can. And then the other one he was talking about was, throwing a bigger slider and not so much of kind of like the in-between slider that he had been throwing. And I know some guys will, they don't want too big of a slider because it can be kind of harder to locate. And Marcus Stroman really, likes to be in the zone and likes to throw a last strike. So I know that might have been a tough adjustment for him, but he said it really did wonders.
Yeah, it definitely, you can't complain about the results if you're the Blue Jays in terms of ground balls, in terms of strikeouts, and, Phillies or not. I mean, he definitely did what they were hoping for. So, I mean, how many starts like this do you have to see before you say, okay, Marcus Stroman's back to where he needs to be?
Well, yeah, I mean, you definitely need to see more, because I remember after his first kind of really disastrous outing this year, he bounced right back against Minnesota and looked terrific, and then it, went off the rails again. So obviously you want to see him repeat it, but, we're still talking about a very young starter here, a guy who's, at really the beginning of his major league career. So, it would have been strange if he didn't go through a slump at some point, and if he didn't skid. At some point, I think we were all expecting that there had to be some adversity for him, somewhere, especially considering, he missed a year of professional pitching, basically, 5 months or 5.5, whatever it was, to get back from that ACL tear. So, there was a lot of development and a lot of learning and a lot of kind of, learning things about himself on the mound there that he missed out on. So, maybe he's just kind of going through some of those, those growth spurts now.
If I had told you, a couple months ago that Marcus Stroman on June the 15th, whatever it is, the middle of June, would lead the American League in innings pitched and in ground ball rate, you'd probably think that he would have a way better start to the season than this.
I would think he'd have a way better ERA. I think he'd be seeing a lot less hard contacts than he's seeing.
Yeah.
It really has been kind of an interesting season in that regard. That's a good insight. When you look at it, the guy's, over 90 innings pitched, and ground balls all day. But also when you kind of look at, the balls that come off of opponents' bats, at 95 to 100 miles an hour, I mean, there's a whole lot of them. And the ERA is up close to 5. So it's been a weird year.
Yeah, there's no question there. Sticking with the Blue Jays rotation, Aaron Sanchez, I mean, I feel like we talk about him every week, but it's always such an interesting discussion around him. And as I'm sure you saw yesterday, John Gibbons on Buster Olney's ESPN podcast said they're moving him to the bullpen. It's going to happen. And I guess this is what we all expected, but for Gibbons to come out and say that reinforces that and sets up, reinforces the expectation that he will be moved to the bullpen. What did you make of those comments, if anything?
Well, I mean, I think John Gibbons wanted to move Aaron Sanchez to the bullpen like a month ago, you know, when the bullpen was really struggling and they just, you know, they were blowing games, you know, on a, what seemed like a nightly basis. I think he really wanted to have him, you know, back there at that point. I'm not surprised John Gibbons is a proponent of, you know, moving him back there at some point. It's going to be tough to do if he's, you know, keeps going out and throwing 7-8 innings of, you know, two runs or less. You know, he got hit around a bit against Baltimore. It was a weird day. The ball was really flying. I mean, the wind was kind of crazy. Rogers Center, it seemed like anything that was up in the air, you know, was leaving the park. I can't believe that, you know, Pedro Alvarez didn't get one off of Jason Grilley at the end of that game, really, yeah, with the way that he hit that ball. So, you know, you can kind of, you know, put that outing aside. I mean, I don't think we're going to see too many four home run games from Aaron Sanchez going forward, but you know, it'll certainly make it easier for them to have that discussion with him, you know, if he isn't pitching as well.
So then that opens up a hole in their rotation. What happens with that?
You know, you got to look to Drew Hutchison, I guess, really. Like, that's the guy, and he's having a fine year in Buffalo. I went down and saw him a few weeks ago, and, I mean, he looked great. He looked like, you know, the Drew Hutchison that we're used to seeing. You know, it's not going to blow you away. It's not going to be remarkable, but he is too good for AAA. I mean, he is good enough to get major league hitters out consistently, I believe. You know, I think he can go out and give you 6-7 innings of, you know, four-run ball. I don't think that's a crazy expectation for him. I don't know how you feel about it.
Well, I think that Sanchez is better than Hutchison. I mean, he's just taken such a big stride forward this year that they're in a position where they might lose a lot in that rotation. I mean, Sanchez has shown that he can get ground balls and he's striking hitters out like he has never done before in the major leagues. And I think there's just so many things to like about what Sanchez has done. I understand the rationale for limiting his workload this year, but they're going to be in for an adjustment, I think, when Sanchez does move to that bullpen, because it's just tough to replace that kind of production. And whether, you know, whether they were expecting it or not, they've gotten it so far. And I think that losing that production or trying to replace it with Drew Hutchison or someone on the trade market, I mean, I think it's going to be tough.
Oh, absolutely. I'm certainly not suggesting, you know, Drew Hutchison's going to be as good as Aaron Sanchez has been this year. You know, and I mean, just, you know, last week I made the argument that, like, look, if Aaron Sanchez is maintaining his mechanics and maintaining his release point, maintaining his velocity, maintaining his spin rates, and if he's not reporting, you know, an extraordinary amount of soreness or, a long time recovering from his starts to the trainers in between outings, keep him in the rotation. You know, I would read those things before I'm going to read, you know, the number beside his, you know, his innings pitched. But yeah, I think there's a difference between, you know, what maybe some people think should happen and what will happen. And, you know, when it comes to what will happen, I think Aaron Sanchez will be in the bullpen at some point this year. But I certainly don't have a gauge on what, you know, when that might happen.
Yeah, I would guess end of July, early August, somewhere in there, you know, with the trade deadline. And you can kind of tie it into what they do in the trade market. I mean, it's almost like what they did in the offseason, where adding Drew Storen, who they thought was going to be really good, that allowed them to stretch Sanchez out in the rotation. Whereas if they hadn't done that, they might have felt the need to keep him in the bullpen.
And that would get him about, what, 7 more starts, something around there?
Yeah, probably in that range. Somewhere in that range, which isn't a ton.
No, yeah, it's not a ton to ask, and it would probably get the innings up to, you know, I don't know. Right now he's at 85, so that might get the innings up to, say, 130. And, and, you know, from there you could tack on, you know, as many more in the bullpen as you wanted to. I know that John Gibbons will be happy to have him in the bullpen because, you know, in a lot of ways, the Blue Jays are still searching for somebody that can get high leverage outs for them out there. It's just tough to subtract that from your starting rotation.
Yeah, and that's the next thing that I wanted to get to in terms of the Blue Jays bullpen, because for the first time this year, we've seen Roberto Osuna struggle, we've seen him falter and deal with a little fatigue after being really heavily used. There was a 17-day stretch where Osuna pitched in 10 games, threw 172 pitches. That's a ton for any pitcher, especially a 21-year-old whose workload the Blue Jays are obviously watching as well. So What do you make of the back end of the Blue Jays bullpen right now, where Biagini has lost a little bit of relevance and Grilly is filling in and, you know, doing his thing, which is entertaining, but definitely not a lockdown reliever. And then you've got Asuna in there who's going through a stretch where he's been used a whole lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that Jason Grilly has been able to kind of, you know, dodge bullets the way that he has in his brief time with the Blue Jays has been really a godsend for John Gibbons, because he hasn't had Roberto Asuna as much as he would like to lately. Jesse Chavez has been better, you know, quietly. He looks like he's turned the corner, but you also don't want to, you know, overexpose him. You don't want to use him too much. You know, Gavin Floyd's at an interesting place right now where, you know, his role is really in flux. I mean, in flux is really, I think, the best way to describe, you know, everyone behind Roberto Osuna in that bullpen. You know, you look at Jason Grilly, who was basically playing his way off of the worst team, you know, in the majors with poor performance. You know, the Blue Jays, you know, trade him, you know, you trade for a song, and all of a sudden he's, you know, closing games.
Yeah. No, it's been a real quick turnaround for him, and I think we've seen it all year. I mean, they're going to go with the hot hand. I still wonder, you know, you look at this bullpen, even if they add Sanchez to it later in the summer, I still think that you've got to be looking around the league at relief candidates, right, as far as the trade market goes, just to see if there's something out there, because right now, I mean, they're still searching. You send Diamond down, you send Loop down, they're still really looking for a lot of different answers there.
Yeah, I mean, those last two spots in the bullpen have just been a revolving door, and nobody who has come through that door has really, you know, performed to the level that you say, oh, this guy needs to be here. This guy needs to see, you know, more high leverage spots. Which is kind of, you know, that's what Joe Biagini did, you know, coming out of spring training, is he really earned his way into some, you know, bigger spots, and now he's, in a way, kind of earning his way out of them. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if Blue Jays are serious about, you know, adding to this team and making a run at the postseason, I mean, they need to acquire relief pitching. And, you know, I think that they have been looking for it. You know, the Grilly trade says to me that, you know, they're not waiting around for July 31st to make this happen.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, that'll be tied into the progress of Brett Cecil and how Storen looks as his season continues. So, you know, I know there are pieces here that could provide them with internal solutions, but man, you've got to be keeping an eye on what's out there as well. As far as the offense goes, this team has gotten off to such a slow start, but are you seeing signs that it's coming around? I mean, a big outburst against the Phillies, a couple big outbursts against the Orioles, the dome is open, the ball is flying. Is this Blue Jays offense starting to look a bit more like the version of this team we saw last year?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, you know, the weather turning and the dome being open seems to have done something for a lot of these hitters. You know, a lot of balls that maybe were dying at the warning track, you know, in months prior, now are now leaving the yard. I mean, you look at, you know, Edwin Encarnacion, he's on one of those tears that, you know, he'll have one or two a season where you just can't get him out. And, you know, either he's going to walk or he's going to drive a ball really, really hard into a gap or over the fence. And he's on one of those right now. And you look at, you know, Josh Donaldson taking just a great swing yesterday on his grand slam on a, you know, on a backup slider that, you know, he was telling us after the game that, you know, he kind of had trouble recognizing pitches like that, you know, at times this season. And, you know, he said he recognized it out of the hand, was able to put a really good swing on it. And that's a hard pitch to keep fair, really. So, you know, that was a really encouraging sign from him. And, you know, Michael Saunders continues to just, you know, hit the stitching out of the ball. I mean, I think that we are seeing the offense turn a little bit. And, you know, it's a really big reason why the Blue Jays have, you know, won, you know, six of the last seven series or whatever it is now, because the offense is finally starting to come around.
Yeah, let's touch on those guys one by one, Saunders, Encarnacion, and Donaldson, because I think that, you know, they've probably been the three most productive hitters on this team. You could at least make that case pretty easily. And yet with Donaldson, I almost feel like with him, there's this perception that he's not hitting, and yet you look at the numbers. He's got a 375 on base. His OPS is 910. He's on the pace for something like 35 home runs. I mean, he's essentially having another MVP season, right?
He absolutely is. I mean, I think he's been on base, you know, in every game since like the middle of May. So, you know, I think it's been a bit quieter, I guess. I think the last year, I mean, Josh Donaldson had so many, you know, you think back to that stat that people kept citing last year that he had, you know, X amount of home runs that either, you know, tied the game or put the Blue Jays ahead. And there haven't been as many of those kind of momentous moments. Yeah. Haven't been as many of those first first inning home runs that he hit so many of last year. So, you know, maybe that's just kind of coloring it a little bit. But yeah, when you look at it, I mean, he's had a terrific season. I don't really know what more you could ask from him, especially a guy who's, you know, been battling some injuries.
Yeah, exactly. Some leg injuries early on in the year, and then of course the injury on his right hand between the thumb and the finger. So it's crazy. And yet you look at the WAR leaderboard just as a quick way of looking at the top players. You have Bogarts, Trout, Machado, Altuve, Donaldson. So he's right in that discussion again. I mean, he's someone who is having that same kind of year, and you know, he's been joined in the last little while by Edwin Encarnacion, who's given his season numbers a real jolt by hitting 6 home runs in 12 games in June. I mean, like you said, Arden, he really is on one of those tears.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's so fascinating to watch because you can sense when it happens. Like, you start seeing the at-bats, and you really see the approach. You know, when I watch him on, and we've seen a lot of these tears now, when I watch him on them, you know, he's just seeing the ball so well, and you see the pitches that he's taking. You see how frustrated pitchers are getting with, you know, the fact that they have to be absolutely perfect and precise to even, you know, get him to think about, you know, swinging at something that isn't, you know, a center cut, you know, hitter's pitch. I mean, it's remarkable that these tears that he goes on. I'm going to miss them when he's playing for another team next year, because it really is just like, you know, hitting excellence at its best.
I mean, you'll still be able to watch them, though, because he'll be doing it for the Red Sox. So that'll be you'll still have a good up-close view when he's replacing David Ortiz in Fenway Park.
We'll get 18 games against them. So yeah,
definitely. Exactly. Joining David Price and company. But, you know, the offense could also is probably where it is right now, in part because of Michael Saunders. And I think that, you know, when you speak about underappreciated guys, everyone keeps expecting Saunders to come back down to earth, and he probably will. He's probably not a 950 OPS hitter who's among the OPS leaders in all of baseball. But what he's done over the course of 2.5 months still is pretty impressive.
Absolutely. And especially when, you know, you look at what he's done before in his career. I mean, when Alex Anthopoulos acquired him, I think that he thought he was getting a decent hitter with some upside in the power department, you know, who come to Rogers Center could, you know, maybe hit some more home runs, maybe see a bit of an uptick in his OPS, but certainly not into, you know, the 950 plus range. I mean, you know, it's interesting because, you know, Michael Saunders, he just, you know, he's a left-handed hitter, and we've seen a lot of tough lefties that these Blue Jays have had to face, and you know, he's hit a bunch of homers off of those left-handers, and, you know, he's shown that, you know, his splits this year, you know, are fine. He hasn't really been exposed, you know, from either side of the plate. He's got that, you know, it's not the prettiest left-handed swing that you're ever going to see, but, I mean, it's working for him.
Another left-handed hitter on the Blue Jays, Josh Tolley, is having a much harder time with the plate. And I think that it's, you know, it's worth noting at this point in the season when he's 1 for his last 34, and that's only 14 games because he doesn't play very often. But, you know, we were asking John Gibbons about this the other day, and it's kind of as though the Blue Jays are just going to ride it out is the sense that I got. But is that all they can do? I mean, Tolley is not here for his offense, but he's definitely not providing much at the plate.
Well, yeah, I mean, who else is going to catch the knuckleball if not Josh Tolley?
Yeah, no, that's what it comes down to.
It's as simple as that, right? I mean, it's that we trying to pick apart Josh Tolley's offensive numbers as if anybody's really shocked that he's not hitting. I mean, it's Josh Tolley. He's not a major league level bat. I mean, I don't think that's a secret.
Yeah.
But he catches the knuckleball better than anybody else in the game, and the Blue Jays have a knuckleball pitcher who's going to throw 200 innings for them, and somebody has to catch those innings. So we saw last year when Russ Martin tried to do it, he showed that he could be adept at catching the knuckleball, but it clearly affected his game in other areas. It clearly affected, you know, his performance at the plate, clearly affected his hands. You know, when you're catching a knuckleball, it's not like you can – the hardest thing to do is to get it in that sweet part of the glove. And, you know, this is a knuckleball that's coming in and, you know, the mid-70s. When you clang that off your thumb or off the, you know, the base of your palm or off a pinky finger or something, like, that hurts. And that's not good. And then you got to take those hands up to the plate and try to swing. So unless you've got some other, you know, knuckleball catcher who can swing the bat really well, readily available, I don't really see a solution.
Yeah, it is funny. You know, you see Ryan Hannigan with the Red Sox catching Steven Wright, and he goes through the exact same thing. I mean, it's such a thankless task. And then, of course, everyone's like, "Oh, well, why don't they hit more?" Well, you know, it's tough to do at the best of times. And you look around, backup catchers generally are not going to hit much for you.
No, they're not. But I don't, you know, I think they'll be better than the, you know, Josh Tully's probably hitting around 100 right now. So I think, you know, the average backup catcher is going to be better than that. But I mean, it's a special circumstance. You know, I think it's just wasted energy by, you know, fans who gripe about it and get upset about it. I mean, it's not going to change. You don't want a guy back there who can't catch knuckleball, because then you got passed balls all day. It's not like Blue Jays score a ton of runs for R.A. Dickey these days anyway. You don't really want to be allowing any other runs to cross the plate based, you know, via the pass ball. I mean, it is what it is, really. I hate to use cliche, but that's what it is.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, as far as the draft, the Jays completed their draft 3 days of making picks, picking these high schoolers, these college players. What stood out to you about the Blue Jays draft that they completed over the weekend?
You know, it was interesting because you kind of got an insight into how this new front office is going to do things. And, you know, it was interesting talking to, you know, or at least hearing Ross Atkins talk about it and talking about, you know, the kind of, you know, the Boston influence that Mike Morov would bring, and, you know, the Texas influence that Gil Kim would bring. And then obviously, you know, the Cleveland influence from Ross Atkins and Mark Spiro. And then, you know, Joe Sheehan and the Toronto influence, you know, Tony LaCava, Brian Parker, guys who have been in the Blue Jays organization for a while. So it's kind of interesting to see how they went about things. I thought it was a really safe draft. You know, you saw a lot of, you know, college pitchers go, not as many, you know, Alex Anthopoulos and that regime kind of, you know, they love like the sexy high upside high school arm, right? With, you know, the Aaron Sanchez, Syndergaard, Nicolino type of guys who, you know, you get when they're 17, 18 years old and they've got just, you know, they throw these really heavy fastballs and, you know, maybe not that great breaking stuff. Like they kind of stand out to you. You bring them in, you try to mold them, you try to build them into pitchers. I saw a much safer draft from this group. What did you think?
Yeah, it's so hard to tell from afar. You know, I think that the draft seems like a lot of other drafts that we've seen. I mean, yeah, there was a big college presence, but you know, you're going to see some of those high school arms too. To me, it's almost like the trade deadline where so much of it is about pitching. You're almost just reminded that half of the guys you take are pitchers and so many of them don't work out. But, you know, it's interesting to follow and try to get at least some video looks at these guys. And before you know it, we'll be talking about them as the Blue Jays' better prospects.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and the one kind of like roll, you know, gamble, roll the dice, if you will, or like the one kind of like sexy pick that I saw them make was Bo Bichette, who out of Florida, you know, obviously son of a former big leaguer, you know, the bloodlines are there. But if you just kind of look him up on YouTube or on his very active Twitter account or wherever, and just kind of look at the way this guy plays the game, like it reminds me of kind of like a Brett Laurie or a Josh Donaldson, which is like the high energy guy. He's got this crazy swing with this huge leg kick, and like his hands are moving all over the place. And, you know, he seems to play the game at 100 miles an hour. He just looks like a lot of fun, honestly. And so that was the one that really stood out to me. It's like, like this is interesting. If they could turn, you know, this is an interesting project for the organization to take on. If they can turn this into a guy, into someone. And, you know, he's another, you know, he's kind of this like undersized guy with, you know, the hair flowing out the back of his cap. Like, he's just a fun player. So I like seeing picks like that.
For sure. Hey, quickly, before we let you go, the Jays are about to finish a stretch where they played a lot of AL East games. After they play Baltimore, it's no more AL East until the end of July. You think that's a little bit of a breather for them as they try to gain some ground against the Orioles and Red Sox?
I guess so, but you know, the most direct way to gain ground is by playing those teams, right? So I think that, you know, the Blue Jays should be commended for the way they got through this recent stretch against pretty much exclusively AL East opponents. You know, we saw them take a series from the Orioles, take two series each from the Red Sox and the Yankees. I mean, that, you know, that can't be understated how important that is, and how that has, you know, gotten the Blue Jays to a point now where, you know, they've got a bit of cushion above 500, and you know, they're right there in the playoff race after, you know, I don't know, maybe, you know, 20, 21 games ago, things weren't looking quite as rosy. So I think that, you know, it'll be interesting to see, you know, how the Blue Jays fare against some different opposition that they don't see too often. I mean, you got four games against the Arizona Diamondbacks, who this team just never plays ever. And then they've got the Indians coming up, who obviously have such a great pitching staff. It's going to be interesting to see.
For sure. Arden, thanks so much. We'll be looking forward to reading your work from Philly.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it.
With the 21st selection of the 2016 MLB Draft, the Toronto Blue Jays select TJ Zoik, a right-handed pitcher from the University of Pittsburgh.
We are back on At the Letters and very happy to be joined by Jim Callis, one of the foremost experts on the MLB draft. You can find him at Jim Callis MLB on Twitter and all over MLB.com and MLB Network. Jim, thanks so much for making the time.
Oh, glad to be here. Glad to be here.
So the Blue Jays, of course, are the focus around here when it comes to the Major League draft. And I think that before getting into some of the specifics, what were your overall impressions of what the Blue Jays did in the 3 days of the 2016 draft?
Some of it's a blur because we're tracking the picks fast and furious, and you don't always it doesn't always settle in immediately. Like if you'd asked me this 2 days after the draft, I'd been like, well, who'd they draft? And I didn't have time to digest. But I mean, I thought they did a good job. I mean, I think the immediate impression you have of a draft is kind of where guys went relative to where you thought they ranked as prospects. You don't necessarily know who's going to sign and all that, but. We go through these guys in more detail, but T.J. Zoik, the first round pick, went where he should have gone. J.B. Woodman, I thought was a second, fourth round guy. They took him in the second round. Same thing with Bo Bichette in the second round. Zach Jackson, went in the third round about where he should have gone. Joshua Palacios was very good early in the year before he hurt his wrist, and he went about where he went. I'm probably not the hugest Kevin Biggio fan as a prospect, but I really like DJ Daniels as kind of a sleeper in the sixth round. So I kind of liked what they did, to be honest with you. I mean, it was pretty much par for the course, and it was kind of cool. They actually took a kid in the 14th round from my local high school up here who went to Elon, but he's from the high school that my kids go to, and Chris Hall went to Nutria High School. So from a personal standpoint, I thought that was kind of a cool deal too.
Awesome. That's very cool. Does he have any kind of chance of being a real prospect?
He's kind of interesting. He was a catcher that they converted into a pitcher, during his career at Elon, and he can hit 95 miles an hour. So, I mean, he was a senior. I think it's a relief-only profile, but he's got some arm strength. So you sometimes see with those guys that they can make it. I doubt that Chris Hall will be making our Blue Jays top 30 at midseason when we update our list. But he's got a legitimate, major league fastball. So we'll see what they can do with him. I thought that was kind of cool, too. And, looking at this also, in the eighth round, they got Kyle Weatherly, who's one of the better junior college prospects in the draft, too. So, I thought the draft looked solid from my end.
So let's get into some specifics at the very top of the draft, where the Blue Jays took TJ Zoik, and he's a college pitcher, throws pretty hard, sounds like his secondary stuff is still in development, which would probably apply to a lot of these drafted prospects. But what do you make of this pick? Is he someone who is going to justify his selection as the 21st overall pick?
Yeah, I mean, you start off, this guy's 6'7", and he can hit 97 miles an hour with his fastball. He'll sit 92, 94 as a starter, and the more guys saw him, the more they liked him. He missed the beginning of the season. He had a groin injury and didn't pitch at the beginning of the year, but more guys saw it. Every time I seemed like I talked to guys about TJ Zoik, he was moving up charts. And you're right. I mean, he doesn't have that consistently good breaking ball. He'll flash an interesting slider and a curve. He probably needs to pick one and go with that. Hasn't used the changeup a whole lot. He does throw strikes. I think he's fairly athletic for a big guy. It's more lack of consistency, I think, on the secondary stuff than you don't see field of spin or he doesn't have a changeup. The changeup probably needs a lot more work than the breaking balls. But I think there's starter stuff there. And, he went, like I said, about where he was going to go in the draft. I think if he doesn't go 21, if I can remember from doing all my mock drafts, I think the Pirates picked 22. I think there's a good chance the Pirates could have taken him at 22. He was going to go right after they picked if they didn't take him there.
Yeah, and a Pittsburgh guy, so it would have been a nice kind of hometown story for the Pirates if they had taken him. But the Jays jumped in. Is he someone you expect to sign reasonably soon, or do you have a sense of what his signability is like? It sounds like the Blue Jays were optimistic, but, I mean, that's what everyone says at this time of year anyway.
Yeah, no, I think he will. I mean, to be honest, most of these guys, unless you're a top guy, most of these guys are going to go in the have a deal in place when you pick him. You aren't going to just take the guy, hey, we don't know what he wants. I mean, you want to know the exact dollar figure so you can so you can plot your other picks and how much money you have to spend on guys. My guess is, I don't know if it'll be this week versus next week, but my guess is within the Blue Jays front office, they know what they're going to be paying TJ Zoik.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And with their next pick, they took J.B. Woodman, who you mentioned off the top. And as a college outfielder, it doesn't sound as though his tools necessarily jump out. But what do you think here? Is he someone who could surprise us with an overall assembly of tools, even if no one skill is over the top?
Yeah, I don't know if you'd throw a plus tool on any of it, but he can do a little bit of everything. I mean, you know, the thing that you'd hold against him is he did not play very well in the Cape Cod League last season. You know, he was okay as a hitter his first couple years at Ole Miss, and he had a rough year with wood bats in the Cape Cod League last year. But his approach was a lot better this year. His pitch recognition was a lot better. He actually was leading the SEC with 14 home runs entering NCAA tournament play. I haven't looked to see if he still is, but you know that was kind of surprising to people. He really got on a tear in the second half. He's got bat speed and strength. I think it'll be average power. I think it could be average hit. He's a solid runner. He has good instincts. I think he can play center field. He's got a good arm for the position. He could steal a few bases. He's a pretty interesting guy. I mean, there are not a lot. This was not a good draft for college position players, and especially college position players who could play up the middle. And he's got a chance to play in center field and be at least average or better across the board. And he was a guy, even coming out of high school, had he been signable out of high school, he would have gone in the top five rounds. You know, so guys liked him then. So I like that pick. It was a good value pick.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess you have to have some of those sprinkled in throughout the draft as well.
Yeah, I didn't mean that like a value, like he was going to sign cheap. I just mean for his talent to get him where they got in the draft, I thought that was a good fit.
Right. Makes sense. What about the guys with a lot of pedigree? I mean, Bo Bichette and Kevin Biggio. I mean, these guys are from baseball families, big stars of the 1990s in Dante Bichette and Craig Biggio, of course. What do you make of these two prospects? I mean, do they have any kind of chance of replicating the successes that their fathers had in the major leagues?
I wouldn't go that far, but they're good. I mean, Bo Bichette's interesting. I saw him win the home run derby at the Under Armour All-American game in Chicago last summer, which is a high school kind of all-star game. He's got a lot going on with the swing. I mean, it's a very busy load, and there's a lot going on. I mean, when he squares the ball up, he can crush it. You know, he does have bat speed. You know, like I said, there's a lot going on in the swing, so we'll have to see how that plays against pro teams. You know, I think he's more hitter than athlete. I mean, he won't be a shortstop. He's probably a second baseman or third baseman. But, you know, there's some interesting, you know, stuff there at the plate. We just have to see how that swing plays, you know, against better pitching. But, like, when he squares it up, he squares it up. And Biggio, I mean, Biggio's not, and his dad's a Hall of Famer, so he's not going to approach his dad's career. And, you know, Kevin gets on base, but, like, I don't really know if there's a consistently average tool. He was running better this year. And so maybe you give him an average run, but, like, there's not a ton of pop. He can hit a little bit, but it's more of a on-base, take pitches, draw walks approach, which when you aren't a big power threat, I don't know if it's going to play the same way in pro ball. He had a 473 on-base percentage this year. He's not going to be that same threat. You know, in college, if you have a good sense of the strike zone and recognize pitches, which he does, you can take a lot of pitches and draw walks. In pro ball, if you're not a big power guy, you know, you're heading to count 3-1, someone says, okay, you know, here's 88 right down the middle. You know, what are you going to do, single?
Yeah.
I don't think that on-base stuff's going to play as well. And he's got good instincts, but he's just okay, fair defensively at second base. So he's interesting. You know, I think he's more interesting because of the bloodlines than he is because of the pure tools. But, you know, I mean, would he be the first gritty overachiever to make it to the big leagues? No. He's got a shot.
Okay.
And, you know, Palacio is his bloodline guy, too. You know, his uncle Ray played in the big leagues. Yeah, he was hitting, you know, 408 before he hurt his right wrist diving for a ball at midseason and then didn't really play much the rest of the way. But, I mean, he's got bat speed from left side of plate. He knows the strike zone. It's a line drive approach. It's not a ton of power. You know, the thing with him that's interesting and it's tough to figure out is I got all kinds of different run times on him. I had some guys tell me he's an average runner. I had some guys tell me he's a plus runner. So obviously there's a variance there. And, you know, my guess is I think the Blue Jays announced him as a center fielder, and I guess they'll try to play him there. He didn't play there at Auburn because they had a guy named Anthony Greer who was a second-round pick who was even faster than Palacios was. And I got mixed kind of results on whether they thought Palacios could play center. I mean, if you think he's a plus runner, you try him there. But other people who think he's more of a, the instincts are not real refined and he's more of a left fielder, which, you know, obviously that's a whole different offensive profile, center field versus left. But I do think, at the very least, you have some pretty good hitting ability there. And a lot of times the guys who have really good hitting ability, you can maybe add a little off their swing or get them to be a little bit more aggressive and you find some more power. But I know he was a guy who really intrigued scouts this year. They didn't have a lot of history with him. I mean, he was at San Jacinto Junior College for 2 years before he got to Auburn. And then when guys really want to go and see him play, I think he had something like 13 at-bats in the final 26 games this season. So it was kind of tough. If he'd stayed healthy and continued to perform like he had, he might actually have gone higher than he did. So it was interesting. I think that was a good round to get him in.
What about Zach Jackson? I mean, he's someone who alternated between the rotation and relieving at Arkansas, and it sounds as though the Blue Jays might give him a shot as a starter, but he has had a lot of success as a reliever and even as a closer. Where do you see him fitting in eventually once the dust sort of settles with his pro career?
I think he winds up being a reliever long term, although I think they definitely could try him as a starter. That happens a lot in Boris. You get him innings to work on things. His delivery is very busy. It's a long arm stroke. There's a lot of shoulder tilt. He doesn't, it kind of hampers his control and command, and I don't think the stuff would hold up for 6-7 innings at a time. I think he didn't have a great year this year. He was kind of the hero of Arkansas's College World Series team last year, where he was a reliever last year, but if they needed 4 innings from him in a super regional, you were getting 4 innings of Zach Jackson, and he got them to Omaha, helped them beat Missouri State. This year he had a rougher year. The team had a rougher year. They kind of jerked him around between the bullpen and the rotation, which I don't think helped. But what he does have going for him, this is about where he belongs. I think if he had a really good spring, he could have been a second-round pick, but he didn't. I do think most people looked at him as a reliever, but he has one of the best breaking balls in the draft. He's got it. It's kind of a three-quarters breaking ball. And a lot of time when you say that, it's kind of a slurve. And it's got like slider break and curveball velocity, but he's got the good three quarters breaking ball where he throws it. It's like got cutter slider velocity in the low 90s, and it's got curveball depth, and it is an absolute weapon. And I mean, as a reliever, you could come in and just destroy guys with that. Plus, I mean, as a reliever, it's 93, 95 up to 97, and the fastball gets a little straight. It's a four seamer, but that's still fine because you could four seam. The guy, if I'm Zach Jackson, I can throw you 93, 95, up to 97, around, the letters, which is going to be tough for you to catch. It's going to look like a hittable pitch, but tough to catch up to.
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, I'm sitting on that. I'm ready. I'm geared up. And then he just throws this filthy hammer breaking ball, like at 90 miles an hour, that drops off at your feet, and you're going to be swinging over the top of it. So I just think that guy could be a closer. If he can throw enough strikes, he can be a closer, because wow, that combination is just ridiculous. That like I said, that breaking ball, that's one of the best breaking balls in the whole draft.
Wow, that's very interesting. It'll be interesting to see how he fares as he gets started. I wanted to ask as well, I mean, when you look at this draft, it's the first one under Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins, even though Brian Parker is still the scouting director, and you still have guys like Tony LaCava and Andrew Tinnish around and informing the Blue Jays' decision-making. Did you notice any difference? Is there anything that we can point to as far as what the new regime has how they've affected the draft?
No, I don't think so, because to be honest, I mean, yes, GMs and team presidents are going to be involved in watching the draft, but it's not like Shapiro or Ross Atkins is going to be saying, okay, we're picking this guy in the first round, this guy in the second, this guy in the third, and we want that guy in the fourth. My guess is, I mean, they had input like into the first pick, but did they probably, I'm sure over the course of the year, wanted to kind of see what the process was that they had in place. I don't think they changed a whole lot.
Yeah.
I don't notice anything particularly different. I mean, I think you could sometimes read too much. You could look at this draft list and say, Oh, you know, they went Mississippi State or Ole Miss, Arkansas, and Auburn. You know, they had three SEC guys in the top four rounds. They're really hitting SEC heavy, and they got, you know, Pitt, Notre Dame, so it's heavy college. But to be honest, that could have just been the way the board blew, you know, worked out too. They drafted a lot of position guys, but again, you know, in the middle rounds. But that could have been the way the board worked out too. So I didn't read anything in particular into what they did this year.
The last one I wanted to ask you, Jim, is about Cal Quantrill. And he went 8th overall, a Canadian from Port Hope, Ontario, someone whose dad played in the major leagues as well. And really, it seems as though he shot up draft boards, even though people viewed him as a first-rounder. At least from the outside looking in, it was a little surprising to see him go 8th overall. But what do you make of Quantrill's pro prospects now that he's in the Padres system?
And he got nearly a $4 million bonus.
Yeah.
So he basically got paid like the 6th overall pick. You know, I was a little surprised. The whole situation was a lot. You know, he had Tommy John surgery he hurt his elbow and had Tommy John surgery early in his sophomore year, and they opted not to pitch him coming back this year. You know, I think his advisors opted not to have him pitch at Stanford, which is probably, you know, best. I mean, why have him come back and pitch in games and, you know, be trying to, you know, maybe go extra and win? You know, he'll be ready to go, like for the Padres. He's signed already. He'll be ready to pitch for him now. You know, they had him throw some bullpens on the side. And basically, if you weren't a team that was going to pony up for him, you didn't even get a chance to look at him. You know, I like Cal Quantrill. A little surprised from the outside looking in.
Yeah.
Not that he went that high, because there was demand. And I actually think he was in the Blue Jays mix. I think the Padres were really hoping initially to get him. They had three first-round picks at 24, 25, and they knew he wasn't going to get to him. And they took him at 8. But, you know, you hear, like, oh, he could have been the number one overall pick had he been healthy, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, could he have been in this draft? You know, I guess maybe, because it wasn't a great draft, but a little surprised on that, because I don't know how much you followed Cal, Ben, but, I mean, he's got good stuff, but it's not wipeout stuff. He can really pitch, and he has a good track record, but it's not like, you know, it's 91-94 with good secondary pitches. It's not, you know, hey, the guy's throwing the mid-90s with, like, a wipeout slider, and you have no chance to hit it. He has good stuff, and he can really pitch. It's a good package. It's the sum of the parts. And to me, like, that doesn't scream out like the type of guy who goes number one overall in a typical draft. Like, to me, he would have been like probably top 10 pick. Well, he still was a top 10 pick, and he got top 5 pick money or number 6 pick money. So a little surprised by that. I mean, I do think he should be healthy going forward, and I heard, you know, he looked good. The teams that got to look at him liked him, but a little surprised. Yeah, that he went quite that high. Well, not quite that high, because like I said, the Padres liked him, but a little surprised he commanded $4 million, or nearly $4 million, you know, given his background. You know, that said, this was a bad draft for college starters. And so maybe, you know, I mean, I think that worked in his advantage, and that's why he got the bonus he did.
Makes sense. Jim, we look forward to following you on Twitter at JimCallisMLB. Reading, of course, on MLB.com and MLBPipeline.com. Thanks so much for making the time today.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Good talking to you, Ben.
That is it for this week on At the Letters. Thanks so much to Jim Callis for making the time and providing some very detailed, very authoritative analysis on the MLB draft. Thanks, of course, to Arden Swelling, who joined us from Philadelphia this week. And thanks for listening. You can follow us on Twitter. Arden is at Arden Swelling. Our producer, Sam, is at Sam A. McKee. And I am at B. Nicholson Smith. In the meantime, you can like, share, you can favorite, subscribe on iTunes, and find us, of course, on sportsnet.ca. Thanks for listening to At the Letters.